I'm Marianne Williamson, and this is Win the Day with James Whitaker.
You're listening to Win the Day with James Whitaker.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
Broadcasting from Los Angeles, California, here's your host, James Whitaker.
Let's go.
Hey, winners, welcome back to Win the Day. If this is your first time here, we sit down with some of the world's true change makers to give you all the tips, tools, and strategies to win the day every day. The quote for this episode, it comes from Maya Angelou and says, "Nothing will work unless you do." Today, we're sitting down with one of the great spiritual leaders of all time, Marianne Williamson, who is also running her campaign to become President of the United States in 2024. Marianne is the author of 15 books, four of which have been number one New York Times bestsellers, and she has been the catalyst for some of today's great change makers to transform the world. Throughout her career, Marianne has worked on poverty, anti-hunger, and racial reconciliation issues. She's the founder of Project Angel Food, a nonprofit that has delivered more than 16 million meals to ill and dying homebound patients. In 2004, she co-founded the Peace Alliance to support the creation of a U.S. Department of Peace and has hosted the Sister Giant conferences that have educated and encouraged thousands of women throughout the country to engage in political activity. Becoming President of the United States is about as lofty as a goal gets, but she spent her 30-plus year career preparing for this moment. The pillars of her presidential campaign are the restoration of America's middle class, including universal health care, tuition-free college and tech school, and a guaranteed living wage. She's also focused on properly educating the next generation, committing more resources to environmental issues, and ending the drug war. Marianne believes the transformation of American society requires that we address the root causes of the problems rather than just their symptoms, a focus that every country in the world should get behind. She's running for the Democratic nomination, and if elected, Marianne will be the first female, the first mother, and the first grandmother to be President of the United States. In this episode, we're going to talk about the biggest problems facing the world today and how to solve them, how to disrupt the educational system to properly empower the next generation, the dirty world of politics and her plan to give it a complete overhaul, and what you can do to step into your power and transform the world. Before we begin, the right bit of inspiration can completely change the trajectory of someone's life. So if there's a friend or a loved one out there who needs to hear this episode or could use some help to win the day, share it with them right now. All right, let's win the day with Marianne Williamson. Marianne, great to see you. Thanks so much for coming on the Win the Day show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And what an incredible journey you had. To kick things off, who was the first person to believe in you and how did that change the trajectory of your life?
My mother. I felt unconditionally loved.
Interesting. Having that someone in the household early on, was that a big part of your sense of giving back to so many other people who may not have had such a close connection to someone in the home like you did?
Well, I did grow up in a loving home, but it also my parents were very giving. They were very giving charitably. You know, when I was a little girl, I remember people, I don't think people do that much anymore, but would knock on your door collecting for this charity or that. And my mother would always say, "My husband gave at the office, but wait here, I'll get you something." And later when I would do that, I would start asking people, sometimes people would say my husband gave at the office and then shut the door. So I grew up in a home where charitable giving, participation in the world in a generous way if possible, meant something. Yeah.
And you once wrote that your playing small doesn't serve the world. What's the difference between those who get stuck playing small versus those who go on to become extraordinary achievers?
Well, I was speaking of that as a woman. You know, it's kind of a joke to me later, amusing when people misappropriated that to Nelson Mandela, because it says who you not to be talented, gorgeous, fabulous, whatever. That's not a man in Africa talking. That's a woman, clearly. But I think that women have had even more than men, the challenge of if you are too much, you won't be loved. You know, someone, I was on a program earlier and there was a quote that this gentleman gave me. He said, if a man speaks outside the box and he comes with something else, he's called a prophet. If a woman does that, she's called a witch. Women owning all of who we are is a trigger to the patriarchy, as they say. And so there are many, many messages that women get from the culture. Just don't be too much.
And you've certainly been a trailblazer yourself, you know, not to mention advising other trailblazers along the way. And what do you believe? Obviously, you're on a very difficult mission at the moment to rise to president of the United States. It's an incredibly impressive mission just to be on. And I love everything that you're doing. What do you feel are the most significant issues facing America and the world today?
Well, in the United States, we've stopped being a government of the people, by the people, for the people. We have allowed huge corporate profits to become the governing principle of our society, too often at the expense of the safety and the health and the well-being of people. That means we've allowed economic principles, and soulless economic principles at that, to supersede democracies, to supersede humanitarian values. It's a terrible swerving away from the core of what a democratic and a humanitarian society should be. Mahatma Gandhi said the problem with the world is that humanity is not in its right mind. You know, if you go anywhere in the world that I've certainly, anywhere I've been, people are decent, but we have social systems, economic systems, even religious systems, political systems of tremendous force and power, backed by military, backed by huge amounts of money, that run counter to the love in our hearts. And that struggle is often played out in history, but I don't think it's ever been played out more dramatically than it's being played out right now. Well, it has been because there have been world wars, but it's a time when humanity does seem to be deciding who we want to be. And in that decision of deciding who we want to be, we're really deciding whether we want to survive long term. Because the path of conflict is a path that is not survivable long-term, given the kinds of weapons that exist on the planet today.
And the attention that we're all occupied with today seems to be going to things like social media and, of course, mainstream media outlets, as have been done forever. These companies make money on stoking that division and creating that negative emotion for people. Is this idea of unity and bringing love and compassion and kindness and self-belief across national and international borders, is this a bit of a pipe dream given what you're up against in terms of some of these outlets that profit from stoking that division?
It's not just the division, because a lot of the division is artificially created. It's the fact that systems make life too hard for people. Like in the United States, too many people don't have adequate health care. Or if they have adequate health care, it's because they're working at a job they hate, but they're there for the adequate health care, or they're rationing their insulin, or they have to work on more than one job, or they're in poverty, or they're near poverty, or their children are hungry, or they live paycheck to paycheck. They can't even find a place to live. The division is the least of it. The suffering is what matters. And if you realize that it's the suffering, then you realize how artificial the division is, because whether people are on the left or on the right, they're being screwed by the same forces. So people are beginning to understand it's not the left versus the right. It's the powerful versus the powerless. And the powerful have access. The powerful have access to money. They have access to the economic power, to the political power. And the system is designed to keep everybody else in their place.
And I mean, how crazy for people who have to decide potentially whether they put a meal on the table for their family or do they put that money toward medicine. You know, I've been living in America for 12 years. I've seen firsthand just these pharmaceutical drugs, how expensive some of these things can be. And is there a part of it where it feels like to achieve the grander mission that you need to cozy up, as given that you're running for one of these mainstream parties, that you need to cozy up to some of these people in the interim who benefit so significantly from the status quo so you can then go and make that change?
Even if I tried to cozy up to them, they would have no interest in cozying up to me. I think my positions are well established. No, I'm not doing this to become one of them. I am not a traditional politician. The path of the traditional politician often leads people to cozy up. That's not why I'm doing this. And those people would have no interest in being cozy with me, even if I did, given the positions that I have. You know, I am a challenge to their way of operating.
What about those traditional pillars of the Democratic Party? Given how much it's changed and evolved over the years, what do you believe are the fundamental pillars of the Democratic Party as you see it?
Well, I'm living, as I think many people are, with some real grief over that right now. I think both Democrats and Republicans are sort of feeling like, what happened to the party we grew up with? The Democratic Party I grew up with was still living with the coattails of Franklin Roosevelt. The Democratic Party was the conduit for unabashed, unequivocal advocacy for the working people of the United States. Starting with Bill Clinton, there was this, it was establishment, there was something called the Democratic Leadership Council. And it was the idea that instead of repudiating and rejecting the dominance of what Franklin Roosevelt called the economic royalists, we would try to have it both ways. And that just sucked all the soul out of the Democratic Party, because you kind of can't have it both ways. Because if you were truly standing up for the working people of the United States, you're standing up for healthcare, you're standing up for free college and tech school, you're standing up for subsidized childcare, you're standing up for unions, you're standing up for paid family leave, you're standing up for affordable housing, you're standing up for a living wage. And what many people within the establishment Democratic Party today do is they want to stand up for those things to the point where they'll stop at any point where they might be challenging the underlying economic bottom line of the people who, after all, are their donors too. Insurance companies, which is why we don't have universal health care, pharmaceutical companies, which is why people can't afford their drugs and so forth. So when I think of the traditional pillars of the Democratic Party, there are a lot of people who are establishment Democrats who wouldn't agree with me today. I mean, I think Roosevelt, you know, Franklin Roosevelt would be considered too left-wing. And I think for someone like myself, the positions I'm standing on, which to me, well, this is what Democrats should stand on, are considered moderate positions in every other advanced democracy.
Absolutely. And do you feel like being a political leader in the world that we're in, this digital age, that it's a bit of a poison chalice that you're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't, no matter what country you're in?
Twitter is such a cesspool. It's so damaging. I mean, the high side of social media is obvious for all to see, but people's careers and lives get ruined for sport. It's to be personally at the effect of that is very painful, but it's bigger than any one person's feelings. It's damaging to our democracy. It means that people get thrown out of conversations that should be in those conversations. It means people are afraid to speak up. People are afraid to say things. It can't continue like this.
It's got to be difficult in the era of technology. We've got bots, we've got AI, we've got these social media platforms where it's almost like who's in charge of regulating the town square? You sort of touched on it there. I'm one of those people that would enjoy, within reason, but pretty much everyone having a voice. So there's opportunities for transparency to see what messages are coming out so we can then figure out where re-education needs to occur. The people who aren't interested in any conversation and they're not interested in listening first, they're the ones that I worry about the most. I'd much rather be someone who ask good questions, can think critically about different situations, seek out experts in their respective domains and then formulate my own opinion. Does it concern you that a lot of people are getting blocked out from having a voice or even having a seat at the table or the town square, even if they might have done some things in the past that have proven to be wrong or to be, a little bit perhaps scandalous?
There's that. And then there's also how vulnerable people are. People who think of themselves as too sophisticated to be taken in by media manipulation how very much manipulated they are by one internet article. Who wrote that article? Where's the research on that article? Or one anonymous tweet? So it's your description of how you would like things to be sounded quite lovely. That's not the way they are. I think that's what, you know, everybody at the beginning of the Twitter age, you know, oh, it's going to be so fabulous. Everybody's going to be so polite to each other. It's not that way. And even though there's still, you know, even with independent media, we thought, well, you know, we won't get all our news from mainstream corporatized media. So on independent media, it'll be so great. But a lot of independent media is just as poisonous in a different kind of way. Now with AI, I mean, anything could happen. I mean, you and I, we all know this. I mean, you and I, 2 years from now, could be having this conversation and the technology will be such that you and I talking like this would all of a sudden be having a conversation about something really doing something evil.
These deep fake videos and all that stuff, like it's scary, isn't it? You've got a four-year-old and a two-year-old. It's weird thinking about what world these kids are going to be growing up in. Like all the stupid things that I did when I was a kid, there's no permanent record of those
so
things.
Oh, true. I think about that. I feel so bad. I mean, when I think of, you know, when I was in my 20s, well, thank God there's no record, right? I was reading about one young woman and I can't remember, it was something about race. And she made a comment she shouldn't have made. Her life was ruined. You know, as a young woman, she made a stupid comment. Maybe she was drunk, maybe she was stoned, you know, young, and apologized a million times. It was almost like she needed to go into witness protection or something. We've got to have forgiveness and mercy. And also, you know, you make a tweet. So what? It's a freaking tweet. So I don't think that there's anything we can do on the outside that's a substitute for an ethical revolution. That's really what has to ultimately happen, is that more of us go, what are we doing? And I also, I think, you know, my politics are on the left side of the political spectrum. But I've certainly learned from running for president that there's every bit of smug, self-righteous, angry stuff on the left as on the right. We all have to look inside our hearts and do some cleanup.
And someone once told me there's 10% of people on either side who are just too far gone, just not even willing to enter the conversation. And it's difficult to have a reasonable discourse about how we can improve society when you have those tensions inflamed by those people on either side at the extreme level.
This thing with Israel and Palestine is such an example of it. I just hope it's a fever that passes. You know, this way that we have of, I'm right, you're wrong, shut up.
Yeah, one of the things that I learned first when I was at business school was the principle of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, that seek first to understand and then be understood. Yeah. It's such a great thing. And basically any situation you're in, that even if, you know, you either ask questions to understand their position, and if nothing else, you're much more informed to be able to guide them to a position that you have. And even being able to connect with them on an emotional level means that if you're taking a bird's eye view of what is the outcome that you really want from this situation, that they may not like you and you may disagree, but they will respect you and you can have an actual conversation about it.
And look, I mean, there's so much going on right now, even college campuses, which should be such an incubator for free thought and everything that you've described, and have become, in too many cases, incubators of everything we don't want.
We'll be back with the show shortly. I've got a quick question for you. Are you living up to your potential? It's a question that shapes your family, your business, and your overall happiness every single day. That's why I'm excited to introduce the Win the Day Quiz. Head over to winthedayquiz.com right now, answer a few thought-provoking questions, and you'll instantly discover how well you're performing relative to your true potential. And here's the exciting part for our Win the Day family. As a fan of the show, you'll receive a personalized and absolutely free action plan to help you win the day every day. Now, just imagine how transformational The results will be when you consistently show up as the best version of yourself in every aspect of your life. Don't miss out. Take the Win the Day quiz now by visiting winthedayquiz.com or click the link in the show notes. All right, let's get back to the show. There are people out there who are faced with very difficult situations where a handout, some support, some financial relief can be extremely valuable, and those people really appreciate it, just as there are people that we can hand things to and they don't appreciate it because it's something that's given to them and they don't have the right mindset to be able to grow and amplify that which they have been given. How do you provide a reasonable balance between handouts for those who need it and will benefit for it over the long term versus things like individual empowerment, personal responsibility, and educating more so they have better skills to be able to contribute more to society?
Well, you begin with children. You set people up to win as children. That's the most important thing. If you set people up to win in the first 10 years of life, you're not going to have to worry about so much of that. That's number one. Number two, it's none of your business whether or not people abuse your generosity. This is not about their karma. It's about yours. Be generous anyway. Third, if it has to do with social systems, even though some people, no matter what, some people are going to play the system. Some people are going to take advantage. It's just going to happen. But that doesn't mean in the larger picture of things, it's not to the benefit of the society the behavior of the society to be generous.
For sure. And you mentioned kids there, like this idea of shaking up the education system, like this is something that's well and truly overdue. Are there some things that you had in mind, you know, maybe at a high school level, elementary school, university, you can take it wherever you want to take it, but how do we shake up the educational system for the long-term happiness and prosperity of the future of the world?
I know in the United States, we're the only major country that bases so much of our educational funding on property taxes. And that needs to stop. So every school in America, every public school should be a palace of culture and learning and the arts. How a nation spends its money is much like with an individual. How you spend your money is a reflection of your values. And we do way too much money of slashing taxes for the very, very, very richest among us, and not nearly enough money, resources given and focus given, particularly to the youngest and to the least among us. So, you know, it's that old saying, you can't tell somebody to, you know, pull themselves up by the bootstraps when they don't have any boots. And I think our educational system should be the crown jewel of our society. In today's world, it's too often a dangerous place, and dangerous not only physically in terms of guns, but in terms of drugs and gratuitous sex. And well, any sex in school would be gratuitous. Things that none of us want our children to be raised around at school. We're living in the United States in a time of that's permanent crisis. You know, these crises, you think, well, drugs is a crisis, or economic, you know, hardship is a crisis, or a disease is, medical care is a crisis, or education is a crisis. But there used to be a sense in this country that the crisis was the exception and not the rule. Today, it's a permanent crisis, state of crisis. And we have to ask ourselves, well, what's underneath this? We can't always be playing whack-a-mole. We have to look, what are the root causes, not just the symptoms? And if you look at the root causes, you see how many of those symptoms are caused on some level by the same thing. And that is the fact that our economy is so unbelievably rigged and skewed at this point in the direction of a very, very few Americans. So whether it's our schools, you know, you talk about education, but we have children who are traumatized before preschool. We have elementary school students who are on suicide watch. We have children at school who are hungry. So we have to talk about it, not just in terms of education, but in terms of the whole child. And we have to talk about it in terms of the well-being of the child from the time that they were born. And a child born into a family, for instance, that is poor, that in which there is no economic opportunity. When you have that level of poverty, when you have diminished economic opportunity, you are bound to see more societal dysfunction of other kinds. So we have a situation where you have to take care of these kids before they even get to kindergarten. I mean, we have in public schools throughout America what they call trauma rooms. Well, why is in the richest country in the world is childhood such a trauma? for so many people. So we have to give people hope back. None of this is going to change until people get hope back. And they're not going to get hope back until this burden is off people's back of the extraordinary chronic economic anxiety that millions and millions of people live with.
Your big focus, I know one of the big focuses anyway, is about restoring America's middle class. Is there anything missing based on what you have shared with us already today? Is there anything that you want to add to that in terms of restoring that middle class? And again, this is something that, you know, around the world, I can see it's the wealthy and powerful are getting too wealthy and powerful, and the poor are getting poorer and poorer and missing out on opportunities. So I think restoring the middle class is a very noble goal for any country in the world.
You can't have a democracy. And if you don't have a middle class, because the middle class speaks to the idea of the equality of opportunity, right? And democracy is about the equality of all people. So it serves us to look at the past. In the 1970s in this country, the average American worker had decent benefits, could afford a house, could afford a car, could afford a yearly vacation. A couple could afford for one parent to stay home and be with the kids. One salary could afford to support a family of four, and that couple could afford to send their kids to college. Now, that speaks to a greater prevalence of a social well-being, emotional well-being, psychological well-being, people who have time and bandwidth for their spouses, for their children, for their neighbors, for their community. But what has happened with this enormous transfer of wealth from the bottom 90% of Americans to the tune of $50 trillion is that too many people are put in struggle mode. People are grasping all the time. 62% of people living paycheck to paycheck. That means one getting sick, one missed payment for rent, one missed college loan payment, one missed medical debt payment. Somebody could be thrown into their car to live there. People are living in a frazzled, anxious state. So when we say middle class, it's not just about economic well-being. Economic well-being determines a level of emotional, psychological, even spiritual well-being. People have to be able to relax at some point. When you have no money, there's no wiggle room. People can't relax. And then the worst of us comes out. And by the way, going back to children, often it's the children who suffer most because the stress is taken out on the weakest member of the family.
Absolutely. If you can't connect with the frequency of a better future, it's very difficult to start to take some of those important actions to get there. And I asked the Win the Day family, I said, if I could ask Marianne Williamson one question, what would it be? I gave them a whole bunch of different options. And this surprised me, actually. This is the question they wanted me to ask you. They said, how do we bring peace to Ukraine and the Middle East? Obviously, America has a long track record.
Like that.
Sorry?
Oh, that.
Yeah.
That old thing. Like that.
Yeah, America's got this track record of being involved in these endless wars. It's something that I've just had a really difficult time with personally. I'm like, what is the point of a lot of these things? Of course, there are some conflicts that require special forces intervention, humanitarian intervention, but what would you do to bring peace to Ukraine and the Middle East?
Well, those are two pretty different situations. So let's start with the Middle East. There has to be a two-state solution. There, I don't see any other way. The Israeli government right now says it's not interested in a two-state solution. And there are people on the left who keep saying they want a one-state solution. If ever there was a setup for a bloody civil war, it seems to me, one-state solution, who would govern this? I think this war needs to end. We need to release the hostages, whatever hostages are still there and alive. We need to stop the war. We need to obviously rebuild Gaza, and we need the architecture of a two-state solution. Now, that's not going to be easy. But it's going to take international involvement on a level that did not occur before. Qatar, Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, UAE, as well as the United States, as well as Western powers. I don't, in my mind, believe that either Hamas or Netanyahu, I have a lot of problems with Netanyahu, but I don't want to be putting him in the same category as the language doesn't even serve here. We need a new class of leadership. We need a new kind of leadership, both Palestinian and Israeli. the part that I find so sad about all of this is that they are there. I've met them myself. There are people all over this world. You know, the traditional Christians would say, God is lifting people up. I think that something is happening on this planet. A new kind of thinker, a new kind of visionary is arising in this world. And they're in the Middle East as well. And those are the people that need to have the levers of power. And that's who we should be supporting. As an American president, it would be incredibly important to me that this be about an equal commitment to the justice and security and sovereignty of both peoples, both Israeli and Palestinian. A lot easier said than done, but the United States should be an active participant in bringing that to be. And that has to begin with ending this war.
For sure. And how do you feel about Ukraine and the Russia involvement and obviously
what's happening here is, of course, we had hoped that the counteroffensive on the part of Ukraine would be successful. It has not been successful the ways that we would have hoped. Basically, the two countries are in a stalemate now. It's just a war of attrition. Vladimir Putin is clearly just waiting to see if Donald Trump becomes president again, because, you know, Trump's a man he can deal with. And he knows that if Trump becomes president, that, you know, they'll make a deal that will make Vladimir happy. I've always felt that there had to be a negotiated settlement, but you want it to be a negotiated settlement in which there is a Ukraine. There are those who say that if you just made a deal with Vladimir Putin right now, that you could, first of all, you could trust him. There's no guarantee, but there are those who say you could trust him. He would not continue to just squash Ukraine, and that basically give him what he wants right now, and that basically, yeah, all good. There are others who say, no, this is what he does. He takes Crimea, takes a beat, comes back, takes a beat, and then would be back again. I think it's a very hard call. And as president, I would not have a problem saying to the American people, I haven't decided yet. There is a temptation on the part of many Americans today to have almost a knee-jerk reaction about such things as Ukraine. And listen, we don't have clean hands there. We don't have clean hands in terms of our involvement in NATO. We don't have clean hands in terms of the Aegis missiles. And also, we didn't have clean hands in terms of, you know, what some have said, Boris Johnson going there, Naftali Bennett saying that there was room at the beginning, that Vladimir Putin was willing to make a deal, Zelensky at some point. You know, I think that this is what's so hard for people. I think when it comes to Israel and Palestine and when it comes to Ukraine, you're not talking about good versus bad here, the way people try to make it. Nobody's got totally clean hands here. And I think that one of the things about Ukraine is that as president, you would be privy to information that probably you and I are not privy to.
And you had once written that you referenced the American economist who mentioned that 1/7 of the annual military defense budget of the U.S. being $100 billion, that would be 1/7 of the more than $700 billion of the annual American defense budget could eradicate deep poverty within 10 years. Where should efforts and resources be prioritized? Should it be more on restoring America's middle class or on lifting the standards for underdeveloped countries?
It's ridiculous for us to think that those two are mutually exclusive. The richest countries in the world, when they meet in their big G8, they could just decide to cancel the debt. Within 10 years, those guys could say, we're going to eradicate global poverty within 10 years.
Seems pretty simple, doesn't it? I agree. Yeah, for sure. Like if you're coming from an abundance mindset, having everyone at a minimum baseline of being able to get skilled up and contribute and make the world a better place for health and connection and everything seems like a smart thing to do.
We have 1 billion people on this planet who live on less than $1 a day. Nobody should find that tolerable. A lot of people say, oh, America is the most generous. No, we're not. We give far less of our money away in humanitarian aid relative to the money given. by other countries. We give a lot in military aid, and we sell arms to 60% of the world's autocrats.
Yeah, a lot of people get rich from these military contracts.
And, you know, not only is there the money made by the proverbial military-industrial complex, we're not even producing the equipment that would be the most relevant in a 21st century war. We're buying and selling product that is 20th century warfare. So much of 21st century warfare would be, for instance, cyber. And we're actually spending probably too little money on national cybersecurity. Other countries are not that stupid. I'm sure China's not that stupid.
If you were grading the terms of the previous presidents that we've seen, if you were grading Donald Trump on his presidency and Joe Biden on his presidency, what grades would you give them?
I would give Trump an F, and I would give Biden a C+.
Opportunities for improvement on both sides. And I know it's been a crazy time for you running for president, doing all of these different things. Are there any essential parts of your daily routine that you make sure to get done no matter what, so you're performing and operating at your best?
My mornings, time of quiet, reflection, spirituality, prayer, meditation. You know, if you wake up in the morning, you take a bath, you take a shower, you brush your teeth. You don't want to take yesterday's dirt on your body into the day. But if you don't take that period of time for personal reflection, prayer, whatever your process is, then even if you've cleansed your body, you're carrying all that stress from yesterday. And not only are you carrying yesterday's stress, but you're carrying the stress of people all over the world. So then people are so mystified why they're depressed by noon. Well, there really is no mystery there, because the world that is actually with us is very sad today. It's very challenging. So you want to set your sights on the world that is beyond us, the world of the possible. And if you don't, life is too exhausting and it becomes hopeless. And you feel today like people are sort of spiraling down, you know, and to cynicism and anger and all those things that you were talking about. I mean, that's where all that, when we were talking about how mean-spirited people are on the internet, it's an expression of people just feeling they have no power except to bring somebody down on the internet.
Sure, it's like someone who's sitting there all day with the news running constantly in the background. I mean, that's so depressing when you hear some of these things. And, you know, a question I'm starting to ask more and more guests, because I think this is important, and I think this is a question that you will have absolutely no trouble answering, considering I've asked it to all the other guests and given your background. But what do you love most about yourself?
I think what I love most about myself is what I love in other people too. I love. But I don't think what I love about myself is any different than what I love in other people. And on a personality level, I think I do have I see where I try to get it right. I see where I try. And I think that even with this campaign, I make efforts sometimes despite extraordinary resistance.
And something I love about you as well, Marianne, is you're not afraid to put your hand up for any individual shortcomings or momentary lapses. I mean, you are in an incredibly stressful, very busy environment. Just because of your background and your experience doesn't make you immune from just some of the shortcomings and emotions that we have as a human. So you being able to be transparent about those, I think, is incredibly inspiring for other people.
I'm a human being. But, you know, I think that's true of anybody running for president. I mean, this is just a stressful experience. I don't think there's anybody for whom it's not. Maybe Donald Trump, because he's a different kind of character than most people. But I think for the normal candidate, I don't care what your politics are, it's difficult.
For sure. Final question before the rocket round. On your best day, what's an affirmation that you would write on a flashcard that you could show yourself on your worst day?
Be grateful.
Let's now move into the Win the Day Rocket Round. 10 questions for some quick answers. Number one, what quote inspires you the most?
Only what you are not giving can be lacking in any situation.
Number two, morning coffee or evening wine?
Oh, coffee. Evening wine is nice too, but it's not a requirement like morning coffee.
For sure. Number three, what's one bit of advice you would give your 18-year-old self?
Oh, relax. And you look so much better than you think.
Number four, what book do you gift the most apart from your own?
There's a book called Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke. I also love Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass. That's a beautiful gift.
Was there a particular lesson from the first one, Letters of a Poet, that really resonates with you?
He says, sometimes you don't have the answer. Live the question. Sometimes you don't have immediate answers. Live the question.
That's brilliant. Number five, was there a vulnerability you once hid within that became your superpower?
Feeling less than. Feeling rejected. Gave me compassion for those who are rejected by the society.
Number six, what's one thing you've learned about failure?
That you have a choice what to do with it. The only real failure is what you fail to learn from. You know, you can use it to just hate yourself. You can learn it to be better next time.
Number seven, if you could sit on a park bench and have a conversation with someone alive or dead, who would it be?
Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. If they were talkative. I mean, I don't know. I can see the one of them not being interested in talking to me.
Hey, that's where the coffee comes in.
So that has to be with that they would actually be interested in talking to me. Where'd you get the idea for that scene?
And number eight, what tool or resource best helps you run your life or your business?
A Course in Miracles.
Number nine, share one thing on your bucket list.
Yeah, it's not so much my bucket list, because when I think of bucket list, it's like you can make it happen. So I don't think I have anything left on my bucket list.
And final question, number 10, what's one thing you do to win the day?
I can be moody. And I think particularly now I can go, and sometimes I just have to proverbially throw water on me, snap out of it. I do think happiness is a choice. And I think if I understand how do you win the day, you remind yourself you're a choice how you see this, you're a choice how you play this, you're a choice what you do with this every moment.
So good. Well, there are a bunch of ways to connect with Maryanne, and we'll link to all of these in the show notes. You can follow her on Instagram at Maryanne Williamson, grab a copy of her life-changing books on Amazon, and of course, support her campaign for president at Maryanne2024.com. Again, all that and more will be linked in the show notes. Maryanne, what an honor. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so, so much. All my best to you.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of the Win the Day podcast. We want to hear your thoughts on what we covered today, so drop a comment on the YouTube version of this episode with your favorite takeaway, any questions you have, or what actions you'll be taking as a result of what was shared in this episode. And if you found value in the Win the Day podcast, leave a 5-star rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link to both of those in the show notes. It'll only take you a few seconds, and more ratings really helps other people discover the show so they can get the mindset upgrade they need, and we can bring more winners into the Win the Day movement. That's all for this episode. Get out there and win the day. Until next time, onwards and upwards, always.